Pull up a chair. I want to take you to a place most of us who fly little airplanes will never see. A steel deck, 4.5 acres of it, riding the swell of the Gulf of Tonkin. It's hot. It's July 1967. The air smells like jet fuel and salt and hot brakes. And there are men working shoulder to shoulder in a space louder than anything you have ever stood inside. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is the hangar. And today is not a happy story. But it is one of the most important stories in all of aviation, and it happened on this very day. So stay with me, because there's a reason the Navy still shows this one to every sailor who ever walks aboard a ship. Before we go out onto that deck, let me tell you who's keeping the lights on today. This show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation Challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. And friends, after today, you'll understand why a coin, a little piece of metal you can hold in your hand, means something. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, the ship is the USS Forrestal, hull number CVA-59. She was the first of the true supercarriers, big enough to launch and land the heavy jets of the jet age, and in the summer of 1967 she was on station off Vietnam, flying strikes north. She had only been on the line a few days. Her crew was sharp, well-drilled, proud, the kind of crew that thought they'd seen it all. The morning of July 29th, they were spotting the deck for the second launch of the day. Picture that flight deck, aft of the island, packed wingtip to wingtip. You've got a row of fully fueled, fully armed attack jets, of 4 Skyhawks, F-4 Phantoms, tanks full of JP, 5 jet fuel, bombs and rockets hung under the wings. Pilots strapped in, canopies down, turning up their engines, waiting for the signal to taxi to the catapults. One of those Skyhawks way aft on the starboard side had a young lieutenant commander in the cockpit named John McCain. Hold that name. You'll want it in a minute. Now here's where it gets interesting, and I use that word carefully because what I'm about to describe took a fraction of a second over on one of the Phantoms. There was an electrical fault, a power surge, right at the moment the ground crew was switching the aircraft from external power to its own internal power. And that surge did something it was never supposed to do. It fired a Zuni rocket, a 5-inch folding fin aircraft rocket hanging in a pod under the Phantom's wing just lit off, all on its own, sitting on the deck. That rocket streaked across the flight deck, across the whole width of that packed deck, over the heads of men who never even had time to look up, and it slammed into the belly of an airplane on the other side. It struck an external fuel tank. Some accounts say it was McCain's airplane, some say the one right next to it. In the confusion of that morning, it hardly mattered. What mattered was the fuel tank ruptured and 200 gallons of jet fuel dumped out onto that hot steel deck and caught fire. And here's the thing about a fire on a flight deck. There is nowhere for it to go. It doesn't run off into a field. It pools. It spreads under the airplanes, under the fuel tanks, under the bombs. McCain scrambled out of his cockpit, ran out onto the nose of his burning Skyhawk, out along the refueling probe, and jumped down into the flames and rolled clear. He was one of the lucky ones. He'd be a prisoner of war within 3 months. But on this morning, he lived. Other men in that pack of airplanes never had a chance to climb out. Now on any Navy ship, there's a team whose whole reason for existing is this exact moment. Damage control. Firefighters. And the man in charge of the crash crew on that deck was a chief aviation boatswain's mate named Gerald Ferrier. Chief Ferrier didn't hesitate. He grabbed a PKP fire extinguisher, purple potassium powder, the stuff that smothers a fuel fire, and he ran toward the flames. Not away. Toward, because he understood something better than anyone else on that deck. He knew what was hanging under those wings. There were bombs in that fire. And they weren't just any bombs. Let me explain, because this is the heart of it. The Navy was flying so many missions over Vietnam that summer that they were running short on modern bombs. So, to keep up, they had loaded some old ordnance, 1,000-pound bombs left over from the Korean War and before, filled with an older explosive called Composition B. And here's the problem with those old bombs. When Composition B gets old, it gets more sensitive, and it gets more powerful. And a modern bomb in a fire is designed to give you time. Cook slowly, maybe 10 minutes before it goes. These old bombs would not give you 10 minutes. Chief Ferrier knew that. He knew that the second that first old bomb reached its temperature, it wasn't going to burn. It was going to detonate. And every second he could hold that fire back was a second more for the pilots to get clear. So he stood there. One man, with one extinguisher, in front of a wall of burning jet fuel, trying to buy time with a fog of purple powder. His crew came up with the hoses right behind him. He got maybe a minute, maybe 90 seconds. And then the first bomb went off. It detonated right there in front of him, and it killed Chief Ferrier, and it killed almost his entire firefighting team in an instant. The men who knew how to fight the fire were the first men the fire took, and it blew a hole in the flight deck, and burning fuel poured down through that hole into the compartments below, where men were sleeping and working. And now the fire was inside the ship, and then another bomb went off, and another, 9 major explosions before it was over. Each one tore a fresh crater in the deck and threw burning debris and killed more of the men fighting to save the ship.
I want you to sit with that for a second. The people trained to handle this were gone in the first 90 seconds. So who put the fire out?
Everybody else, cooks, yeomen, airmen, 19-year-old kids who had never held a fire hose in their lives. Picking up the hoses out of the hands of the dead and doing the best they could figure out, they fought that fire for hours. They pushed burning airplanes over the side by hand. They carried bombs, live bombs, to the edge of the deck and heaved them into the sea. Sailors from another carrier, the Oriskany, which had had her own terrible fire the year before, came alongside and hollered advice across the water, because they'd learned it the hard way too.
By the time the flames on the deck were beaten down, it was the middle of the afternoon. The fires down inside the ship burned on into the next day.
134 men were dead, another 161 were hurt. It remains, to this day, one of the worst losses of life the United States Navy has suffered since the Second World War, and it happened without a single enemy anywhere in sight. No MiG, no missile. An electrical glitch and a rocket and a puddle of fuel. Now, here's why I make you listen to a story this hard. Because the Navy did something with it. They didn't bury it. They studied it. Right down to the second, and they let it change them. They took cameras and film shot from the island that day. Real footage of that real fire. And they built a training film out of it called Trial by Fire. And they made it required watching. If you serve on a ship, you see it. Because they wanted every single sailor to understand in their bones that fire is everyone's job. Not just the crash crews, everyone's the whole idea that any sailor, cook or clerk or captain, is a firefighter first that came out of the ashes of the forestall.
They fixed the ordnance. Those old oversensitive composition B bombs went away. They tightened up how aircraft were wired so a stray surge couldn't fire a weapon on deck ever again. They built better washdown systems, sprinklers that flood the flight deck to sweep burning fuel over the side before it can pool. They redesigned firefighting gear and where it's stowed so it's always within reach. And they named a school after him. The Navy's firefighting school, where they teach sailors to run toward the fire the way he did, carries the name of Chief Gerald Ferrier, a man who stood alone in front of a bomb with a fire extinguisher because he understood better than anyone exactly what standing there was going to cost him, and stood there anyway. That's the payoff, friends. Not a happy ending, but an honest one. Every carrier sailor who has served safely in the 60 years since owes a little something to the 134 men who didn't come home from that deck on July 29th. And I'll tell you why an old tail dragger pilot who's never set foot on a carrier thinks you ought to know this one. Because everything we do, every checklist you run, every fire extinguisher clipped to the cockpit floor of your Cessna, every fuel handling rule at your little grass field, every one of those exists because somewhere, sometime, somebody paid for that lesson in a way you'd never want to pay it. Aviation safety is written in names. It always has been. We just don't always know the names today, you know one. Gerald Ferrier, the best account of that day I know is a book called Sailors to the End by Gregory Freeman, and the U.S. Navy's own Naval History and Heritage Command keeps the record straight for anyone who wants to read it. And if you can ever find that old training film, Trial by Fire, sit down and watch it. It's a hard 20 minutes, it's supposed to be. You can find the rest of what we do over at RadioHangar.com. I'm Tail Dragger. Go easy on each other out there. And the next time you clip that extinguisher back onto the floor of your airplane, give it a pat. Somebody earned it for you.